Welcome to the Climate Hour. I'm Bob Grove, your host. Tonight, we're going to discuss sustainable food, the environmental impact of what we eat, how we as individuals can make food choices that both improve our health and longevity, and also help us save the planet. We're joined tonight by Stan Slaughter from Missouri Organic Recycling, Meredith McAllister from Compost Collective KC, Mark Garron from Cultivate KC, David Haken from Kansas City Drawdown Society, and Hillary Noonan from Mad Hatter Compost Tea. Thank you for joining us, everyone. Our climate crisis is actually a series of cause and effects. Greenhouse gases in our atmosphere are absorbing heat from the sun and causing an increase in the average of the Earth's surface temperature. This global warming causes long-term changes to the planet's weather patterns, and this climate change causes weather disasters, hurricanes, floods, droughts, wildfires. The weather disasters are costing us billions of dollars in lives and property damage. And the way we fight them is by stopping their root cause, and that's reducing the amount of greenhouse gases in our atmosphere. Our food choices play a big role in greenhouse gas emissions and also in carbon sequestration. The EPA reports that food accounts for 24% of global greenhouse gas emissions. That's quite a bit. That's only 1% less than all the power plants, electricity, and heat production in the world. And animal agriculture specifically accounts for 14% of global greenhouse gas emissions. That's equal to the entire transportation sector. Think about that. Animal agriculture produces as much greenhouse gas emissions as all cars, trucks, trains, planes, and ships worldwide. So our food choices have a huge impact on the environment. An Oxford study did an analysis of 40,000 farms worldwide and found that food crops, vegetable foods, grains, et cetera, produce 3 to 5 kilograms of greenhouse gases per 100 grams of food. Now, if we look at fish, pork, and poultry, they produce around 5 to 15 kilograms of greenhouse gases per 100 grams of food. And at the top end of the scale, we see beef, which produces around 105 kilograms of greenhouse gases per 100 grams of food. In general, the best carbon footprint of beef production is higher than the worst carbon footprint of pork and poultry. And the best carbon footprint of pork and poultry is still much higher than the worst carbon footprint of food crops. Worldwide, moving to a healthy doctor-recommended diet, and that's a diet where we have smaller servings of meat and more fruits and vegetables, that would reduce global greenhouse gas emissions by 3.5 billion tons over the next 30 years. And if we were able to move closer to a vegetarian diet, that could reduce global greenhouse gas emissions by 7.5 billion tons. In terms of land use, livestock uses 83% of all farmland to produce just 18% of global food calories. On the other hand, food crops, they just use 17% of all farmland to produce 82% of the world's calories. And agriculture is 92% of the world's water consumption. It takes 26 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of tomatoes. It takes 1,857 gallons of water to produce 1 pound of beef. And it takes over 1,000 gallons of water to produce just 1 gallon of milk. Our food choices also affect our health and longevity. A study published by the National Academy of Sciences found that moving to that healthy doctor-recommended diet would save 5.5 million lives over the next 30 years. And moving to a vegetarian diet could save 7.5 million lives. Economically, moving to that vegetarian diet could save us $500 billion in environmental cleanup, nearly $1 trillion in healthcare costs, and $28 trillion in value of life benefits. Overall, it feels like our personal food choices can be a real game changer. So David, I'd like to start with you. I know that the Drawdown Project ranks food in its what, the top 5 drawdown solutions?
Yes, and it was a surprise even to the researchers just how much impact that had. And so there are sustainable food initiatives cropping up all over the world through these drawdown communities that are doing things like the Kansas City Drawdown Society started having plant-based potlucks every time we gathered. And I think that the social aspect of what needs to change is really important, that there's so much culture built up around the standard American diet. and developed countries' diet that is really heavy on meat, that asking someone to change their diet is probably a bigger ask than getting them to put insulation in their attic or other things that reduce their carbon footprint. But what I love about plant-based diet as a solution for people that want to reduce their carbon footprint is they actually save money when they do it, and their health is better.
Now, when we talk about a plant-based diet, and that's maybe the gold standard, really in terms of greenhouse gas emissions, moving to a Mediterranean diet, or what they call that healthy global diet, which is just reducing the amount of meat you have, can have almost the same impact. Not perhaps not as great of an impact on your health. I know the solid plant-based diet is very impactful in terms of cancers and heart disease and diabetes, those things. But when we're talking about climate change, moving to a Mediterranean diet, which is more fish related, small 4 ounce servings of mostly white meats, eliminating a lot of the red meats, those have very nearly the same greenhouse gas reductions as moving to a hard vegan diet. Do any of you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think you need to look at the systems as a whole. So while cutting down on meat, or rather increasing fruits and vegetables, there's no doubt. But when those fruits and vegetables are doused in Roundup, there's a really big health problem with that. So a lot of those numbers change when you talk about regenerative agriculture. And regenerative agriculture, whether you choose to eat the animals or not, actually has a negative carbon footprint. So the same company, Qantas, that I think they used the ROTS number on CAFO beef. So beef that's traditional, what you go into the grocery store and buy is 33 kilograms per kilogram of meat. Beyond Burger is 4. So that's huge. Regenerative beef is -3.5. So it's a really big difference, and it's an important difference because getting that carbon back into the soil is absolutely essential. When you do that, you can cut down so much on so many of the chemicals that are going in, and that's not even counted into the carbon numbers. And while you're doing that, you're also affecting climate change because you're storing some of that carbon, you're cycling the rest of it, and that's the natural process that's been on Earth and kept it at a temperature the humans can live at.
When we talk
And
about
when you're
regenerative, and I think regenerative is a really important subject. Those of us that are consumers, how do we eat regenerative? I mean, that's almost a subject that we have to address the farmers and encourage farmers to move into those regenerative techniques that are going to sequester carbon. And that's a huge topic within itself. But how do we, as most of us are city dwellers, how do we access that? Are there local sources of this kind of meat?
there are. It's tough. So when I first started looking, because I got so sick from Roundup and all that sort of thing, it took the better part of a year for me to find good sources. And not everybody's definition of regenerative is the same. And it's really important that we don't allow greenwashing on that. It's not okay. And I've heard people stand up and say organic and regenerative and permaculture and all the rest, it all means the same thing. No, it doesn't. There isn't one system in place for determining if you're regenerative, but regenerative actually means that you're storing carbon. There are some programs. There's the, I think it's EVOL, EVOL maybe. That Savory Institute is a part of, where they are matching corporate partners with farmers so that the farmer knows that they won't lose money on crops, that everything that they're raising will go to a company. So Epic Jerky is regeneratively raised. There is some greenwashing in there because there are some big companies that it's a little questionable how they're determining. Audubon is a much easier certification to get, but they're not actually measuring carbon in the soil. And carbon in the soil is really your best measure of whether or not you're regenerative.
Stan?
Well, Kansas City has a huge network of farmers markets, and most of the farmers there are doing something better than, a step above what you would find in the grocery stores. And they're at least being raised locally and it's fresher. Most of the time I'm finding when I talk to the farmers that they're using significantly better materials, compost for the fertilizer, that kind of thing, that make the food healthier. And that's, you know, use the economy, spend your dollars, vote for good food. And, you know, we haven't bought a piece of meat at a grocery store in a decade. And it's possible to do that. And I recommend it. There's, as Hillary was saying, the nutritional value, the difference in the cholesterol makeup or the fatty acid makeup in the meats are amazing. And the taste is terrific. So, you know, we have a lot of resources as far as finding farmers markets and using them. And that's, you know, if we build it, they will come. If we buy it, they will grow more. So I would suggest heading that way.
Of all the things we can do to help climate change and these other issues, health, it seems like food is the simplest one we can do. I mean, we just, as you said, we vote with our pocketbook. You know, it's what we buy at the grocery store. It's what we buy at the restaurant. And, you know, if we choose to buy what's often cheaper, sustainable solutions, we can all have a big impact. Mark, you're with Cultivate KC. I mean, what are your sources for this kind of materials? What kind of foods are you producing?
There's definitely some meat producers in and around the city, which Cultivate, we mostly work with the urban farmers. Obviously the land availability in the urban setting is much more attuned to fruits and vegetables rather than livestock. But there's definitely, you know, the cities offer good opportunity for chickens, as you can see, is a lower output. There is some local hog and some local beef as we get into the peri-urban areas. But mostly fruit and vegetables in the city, I would say, setting. Now, but it doesn't mean the city doesn't offer, as I think mentioned before, the consumer base that can really drive agricultural decisions. And it doesn't, I think, it's not necessarily trying to say beef out entirely. I don't know that that's a reasonable answer for the American public currently, but how the beef is grown is certainly a reasonable going to, as mentioned, regenerative practices, rotational grazing, having much different impact than the CAFO would.
At least one of your growers has brought in both cattle and sheep to graze on the Westport farm, which was a lot of fun. Cows on Gillum. It's great. It's not
Stan?
A constant thing, yeah. But it was great.
David, I think David had a comment.
Well, I just want to throw out that coming soon is some standardization for regenerative agriculture with the regenerative organic certification. And it's out of pilot, so theoretically, before too long, you'll be able to have not just a certification label for something that is totally regenerative, but also labels for farms that are on their way to transitioning from traditional chemical farming to regenerative organic, and be able to help those farmers who are on the way to their three-year certification, which I think is really important because they need to have a market for their food that is grown on land that has been in trouble, but they're using the correct practices to get it back. to where it should be.
I'm seeing that. I mean, we're talking a lot about meats and beef, particularly. You know, American is the highest consumer of beef in the world. I mean, we really have a beef heavy diet, and it seems like most of what I'm reading indicates it's healthier to have less meat, beef, you know, eat other meats, and in general, reduce meats. Again, that healthy diet where we eat more fruits and vegetables. You know, Americans are just really bad at that. At the same time, and I know we have to recognize that the ruminant animals, the cows, the sheep and such, they're important to the health of the land, because it's part of that grazing of those animals that creates fertile soil, great grass. You know, if we're talking silvopasture, where we're, you know, we're grazing animals within forest areas, they're part of the ecosystem. So we absolutely need them, but we don't necessarily need to be deforesting the Amazon to mass raise cattle and, you know, then ship them to a CAFO and feed them on grain. I mean, it's that process that's more or less destroying our environment, destroying the planet. Stan?
To that point, Alan Savory and the Savory Institute, who's kind of the father of regenerative grazing, talks about brittle land, land that's dry-ish, land that's on the edge, can't really do very good vegetable production there, but it's a huge amount of land on the world at the margins of our humid areas, like the Great Plains, for example. And the best way to handle that is to have a moving colony called the gut of an animal. Gather that dry, rough stuff, process it microbially, and poop it out as a nutrient-rich source while building, you know, some producible, you know, some usable meat tissue. So putting that back in place, you know, the old 80s topic was the Buffalo Commons. And Savory mentioned that when the herds left the land degraded. And we're in that process of degrading so much land between the fallowing that they have to do out there between growing grain crops. They take every other year off because there's not enough moisture to grow the corn as far out as they are. Well, the grass would grow fine. And, you know, it would diversify into a soil building plant biome as well as, and then become a habitat where the grazers could do some good. And it's really the best way to manage land.
Hillary.
There's a really interesting, actually, I don't know if it's a study yet. I don't know if it's been written up, but an event in the Tubbs Fire in California, hugely destructive fire. People died, build homes destroyed, forest burned down. There is a ranch called Pepperwood Reserve. And all they've done is put cattle on it and then manage them according to the Alan Savory holistic management system. In the Tubbs Fire, the firefighters got there and they have a mixture on that estate of silvopasture and open pasture. When the fire was coming over the crest of the hill, the cattle all moved under the trees because that's what their instinct tells them to do. That fire burned very, very differently, burned differently than our prairie fires generally do at this point, because the soil was holding so much water and the trees weren't dry because they were able to get water from the soil. And so the fire flashed through the grass and was gone. No people were hurt, no buildings destroyed. They didn't even lose fence posts because the soil was in good shape just from the way they were moving cattle. So it's a very different kind of burn than even the prairie burns we do now because of the way we manage them.
For some of our listeners, some of these terms were thrown around. I know silvopasture is where we're grazing animals within a forested area. So it's kind of, instead of deforesting just, you know, grasslands, you have trees and such. That's what Hillary's talking about. We've also mentioned managed grazing, which is where, you know, you graze your animals on a small plot of land and then move them to a different plot of land. So they're like rotated around instead of eating that one section of land down to the roots. You know, you let them crop the top, you let them fertilize it, and then you move them to the next section of land. And, you know, regenerative agriculture is kind of the way my grandparents farmed. You know, you're rotating crops, you're probably not plowing. I mean, you're plowing, but you're not stripping the land. So no pesticides, no herbicides. You leave a ground cover on the land and just plant your seeds among that. So I think those old techniques are the new techniques we're talking about. And, you know, we just need to go back the way things were before we became a corporate farming system. We've talked a lot about these techniques that seem to be appropriate for the small farmer. But I know my family generations, I mean, I come from North Missouri, Iowa, and all my family were farmers, a small family farm. And at this point, you know, we've all lost our farms. You know, all of my relatives have had their land bought up by the big corporates. And for them, it's factory farming. You know, clear the land, push as much whatever through that as you can, use chemicals, use steroids, use antibiotics to get it grow fast, then throw it into a CAFO and, you know, gain the weight, send it to market. How do we move back to the small farmer? I mean, just economically, are there programs or ideas that could help us incentivize the small farmer to recapture their land and start doing these small farmer managed regenerative techniques?
Sure. Savory, again, as one of their programs, will actually match small ranchers with companies that promise to buy everything that they raise regeneratively on their land. The really big problem for small farmers, if you have less than 5,000 acres, you have to have a day job. And so you can't really be there to watch how far down on the grass the cattle have chewed before you move them into the next pasture. Becomes much more difficult. So we need a way, it may be carbon, that if they can show that they're sequestering carbon in their soils, that
carbon credits.
Right, carbon credits. Carbon credits are often traded with a company that doesn't have a way of lessening their carbon footprint. So there are a lot of different programs that can be in there. You know, USDA right now pays for conservation strips that do next to nothing because they're generally turf grass. They get sprayed by everything that the farm is getting sprayed by. I can tell you in engineer's terms that the coefficient for turf grass is slightly above concrete. So there are things that we can change pretty easily. And I would think we'd want to start with a healthy soils movement in every state.
David?
I've done quite a bit of looking around for places that are helping support people with small farms go regenerative. And Farmers Footprint is relatively new and one of the best places that I've found because it pulls in all this diverse information in one place, including the financial. And I think that that's, you know, one of the challenges for getting farmers to transition or getting young people to be successful in starting, buying up land and starting a small farm, is there so many different things. There are people that are experts on the greenhouse end of it or ponds and key line plowing, and someone else is an expert on cover crops. And I love the way Farmers Footprint pulls all of that into one place so that it's accessible.
We're talking a lot about meat. Let's shift to the opposite side of that formula, the fruits and vegetables, you know, the plant-based foods. Let's talk about those for a while. You know, by all analytics, you know, that's where we need to go. And while we may never give up meat, that's important. We need to eat more of those and we need to source them locally and all those things. Mark, I'd like to give you a chance to talk about Cultivate KC. I mean, that's your area of expertise, the fruit, the veggies. You know, what's happening and how do we as consumers tap into that?
So for us, it's, and I think a lot of farmers, it's more, we accept, it's not that we accept it, but we know the climate is going to keep warming regardless. It's going to take worldwide efforts to halt that approach. So a lot of our focus tends to be on how to create more resilient farms that can survive in the coming future until things are turned around. Not that we're not participants in, you know, actively trying to mitigate climate change, but so we work in manners of, you know, how can the farm stay in business in the meantime, which that can mean, and that can be a different thing for every farm. That could be somebody putting in a key line system to mitigate the water on the prop and keep more water on the land so they gain irrigation and gain deep, less compaction on the soil. That could mean the farmer is going to be looking at adding shade structures so they can actually get their crops started in the summertime that they need to grow in the fall. It could take on a wide range of resilience strategies, but so that's something we do concentrate on for vegetable farmers, because what we see is, and I think this may be this across the board, but at least for our area, what we see is massive downpours of rain. You know, instead of getting gentle rain, you might get 6 inches of rain this weekend and then have 2 months of drought. So, you know, it's how to deal with that changing type of weather pattern strategies. We don't necessarily want to move all the water off the property. That could be your first inclination, because you don't want your crops to flood. But if we're not going to have water soon after, we need to try to work at keeping some more of that water on the land. We also see pests show up earlier in the year. Different, like this past year is the earliest majority of farmers in the area would have seen aphids show up. And were very large populations early in the season causing problems in Nebraska crops. So we see, and then we see the potential for pests to have additional life cycles with higher heat units. We have additional life cycles that are potential in some pests like aphids or like the spider-winged drosophila, which affects our fruit growers and such. On and on.
I see a lot of, I mean, I live in Midtown, and I'm seeing a lot of yards that are being converted to crops. People that either have raised beds or, you know, they've just eliminated the sod and they're growing, you know, corn, peppers, tomatoes in the front yard. Is that something that your group works with or provides training for? Stan, did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I think you need to trap more squirrels. And I've rehomed 15 squirrels this fall. I'm planning to do more as soon as I get more peanut butter. But
I thought you were trying to address the meat problem by eating squirrels.
There was a story about the Hmong Vietnamese students that were recruited at the University of Missouri, and then about a week later, all the squirrels disappeared off campus. So that's a possibility, but.
Home gardens.
We have a service at Missouri Organic called Sudden Gardens that I've actually brought to Missouri Organic that I started before that. And I usually advise about 40 to 50 people a year on how to get started, where the raised bed needs to be, why not to build your raised bed 3 feet high, all the pros and cons of siting and that kind of thing. We no longer provide the bed building and that kind of stuff, but there are very simple systems available to contain a raised bed. But anyway, we do see a lot of that and more and more all the time. The zoning laws have been made very helpful in Kansas City for gardening and chickens and that kind of thing. I believe we've got all kinds of potential for the Missouri River bottoms. The Kaw River between Kansas City and Lawrence was once the largest food production unit in the entire Midwest. All those fertile river valleys that we have up and down the Missouri from Kansas City. could be greenhouse, the story of greenhouses in Spain and Portugal and how they're working to have year-round food in that temperate area and mitigate their droughts with greenhouses. It's just, it's exploding there. And we could do that if we were serious about it. The one last thing I want to say a little bit more about is the waste side of the food system, and that composting and food waste is the by far the most accessible piece of the drawdown puzzle that I can see for most people, because not only are you involved in the choices, but you're involved in the way you handle the food waste itself. And that's the backyard composting, still the most effective and the best compost that I've ever made. I make it, God bless Missouri Organic, but frankly, we make better compost in my backyard because it's slower, richer, more diverse, and I believe more alive. And so we need both, and more people composting, if they really understood the benefits, could make a big difference. And Meredith, you're a part of this.
Yeah, well, I do want to speak to home gardens. Dan, didn't you mention that home gardens just skyrocketed during the pandemic? So that's one,
oh, yes,
one pro people have taken away.
Let's talk about composting. And I do want to get into food waste because that's a huge factor in greenhouse gas. But let's talk about composting because that ties into the home garden and food waste and all of that. So Meredith, tell us a little bit about your company and what you're doing.
Yeah, so Compost Collective KC is a residential food waste collection company. So we just try to make composting really easy and clean for people. I think that there's a bad rap with sometimes backyard composting that it's maybe dirty or too hard. And our goal is to just make it easy. We give people a bucket and they fill it with scraps and we collect it, and it ends up at Missouri Organic.
So you're doing curbside pickup?
Curbside, and we have a few locations around town that are more like centralized spots that you can take your bucket to. And I will say we've turned a lot of people on to backyard composting. I think one huge pro when you compost in general at home is that you're realizing how much food waste you have. And a lot of people didn't know. A lot of people have no clue. They realize that, like, I had 4 bags of trash every week, and now I have 1 bag every other week. And when you have that volume of food waste, you want to get it down. And we really encourage people to do that, to see how you can stop wasting so much food. We talked about this a little bit, like overproduction of food. This is absolutely a systemic issue, but we as a country produce way too much food, and we're buying way too much food, and then we're wasting way too much food. And I think when you're able to see it, you know, in your compost pile, whether you have a countertop pile, or whether you have one of our buckets, or you're taking it straight outside, you're able to actually get eyes on your food waste, which I think is really important. And we've trained a lot of people. Some people have used our service for a little while and they get inspired and they leave us and they start doing backyard composting, which we, more power to them. we definitely love it when that happens. So,
well, Stan was saying the quality of your backyard compost is probably the best you can get.
Yeah. It's got more seeds in it, but the humus factor is much better.
David?
Well, when I talk to people about food waste, what seems to really get their attention and get the penny to drop and get them doing things differently is the fact that the food waste that they're putting in the landfill is anaerobic, and it produces methane, which is 25 times or more potent as a greenhouse gas than CO2. And that really gets people to think, well, here's an easy way for me to make a difference and be part of the solution. That's one thing I try to mention to people, because I didn't know that before, you know, diving into the information and drawdown. And our group has had some success with getting people to do worm composting. which from what I've heard is the gold standard of compost. If you can get the worm casings and compost from a worm bin, that's going to be better for your plants than just about anything. And that's been really exciting because we've got over 100 kitchens where people are worm composting right in their kitchen and finding it really easy. I've actually done some babysitting for people's worm buckets. Go out of town, they're going, oh, you've got to take care of my worms while I'm gone.
So it's kind of like having a pet.
Yeah, and you adopt a worm colony, and it is, the only problem is you have a lot of compost you have to give away or use.
Or start those home gardens.
Yeah, or split into another bin and give it to a friend. A lot of people are doing that have these.
We're thinking Christmas presents.
Well, it's, once it's an ongoing worm bin, it smells just like a forest. It's very easy. Right. You just put the food in, cover it up, aerate it, stir it around once a week. People get to where they love their worms.
You don't have to name them. They're great pets. You can leave for 2 weeks.
So it sounds like, in terms of changing our diets, improving our health, saving money, saving the planet, moving to, the more fruits and vegetables. If you're so inclined to have that hobby and start gardening in your home, in your yard, whatever. And I think it's wonderful that even urban in the cities here, we can do these little patches and raised beds in our yard. If you're doing that yourself, you're getting better quality food, you're getting healthier food, and we're eliminating that entire transportation element of, shipping fruits and vegetables from South America, which, that's a large carbon footprint. Plus, that stuff's probably irradiated, frozen, who knows what, by the time it gets to you. So how nutritious is that?
And I share with my neighbors, which is really, because it helps.
You're talking about what you're growing in your yard and then sharing it with the neighbors? Absolutely. Oh, yeah. Community gardens.
Those little brown paper sacks on the neighbor's doorstep. Whoa, you are in when you can deliver that,
And it's the embarrassingly large cucumbers, though, that people just look at them and say, what are they? It's a cucumber. I'm sorry, it's 3 feet long. I don't know why.
Yeah, I think if you're interested in doing a home garden, then composting is important because you need that soil. That's just part of the cycle. Right. I think for those that aren't ready to move there yet, people like Meredith, Compost Collective, it's a way of going ahead and getting your food scraps into the system without actually having to do it yourself.
Absolutely.
And I think that's a wonderful idea. When you mentioned just composting, if nothing else, it shows you how much food you're throwing away. Right. And that's money out of your pocket. It's not only bad for the environment and landfills, but it's money out of your pocket.
It's a tremendous example to our children, because I've toured Kansas for 17 years, and even in Kansas, all over the rural country, you didn't see people who knew the loop. Young children who didn't know where food came from, and when you take food, make compost or worm castings, put it on the soil, grow a vegetable, you've been involved, you're definitely interested. It's probably one of the best motivational tools, and the first time and maybe the only local place they can get an example of this cycle of life.
Absolutely. Which kind of segues.
Sorry, just going to say I'm really grateful for Meredith and Stan and their efforts in the city. We don't have grazing animals in the city in general. So we have to find other ways of closing that loop. And instead of making methane, as David was speaking about, that you can make something that then you can put back into your garden. And that's the way that you make up for not having those ruminant animals, is by having microbes.
I want to go ahead and move into food waste. As important as plant-based food is, and David, I think in terms of the drawdown hierarchy, plant-based food is like the fourth or fifth highest solution. Food waste is even higher than that. If we reduce food waste, it has an even greater impact. You want to start with that, Stan?
I'm just saying it's number three. And last time I checked on the hierarchy is reducing food waste. And I work for Missouri Organic Recycling, and we're now composting 400 tons a week. And it's pretty massive. And our one site is nearing its capacity, and it took a lot of money to get it to that capacity, and we're working it as fast as we can. But it's fascinating. We grind it, depackage it, take the cardboard and the plastic out of it, send that to a cement kiln to be burned as a refuse-derived fuel, so there's no landfill waste in the whole process. And corporations are loving that because they get a higher corporate score for their not sending anything to landfill. And so we're getting the Kroger chain, Dillon's, a lot of corporate people coming on board. And, you know, it's a problem we love to have. Is, but what comes out of that machine is liquid food slurry. And we pump it in liquid with adding leaves and stir it. And it's the only system in the country that takes a liquid nitrogen source, mixes it with ground up leaves. And it's the best recipe for compost I've ever seen. And it takes off. It does very, very well.
So you're actually taking food waste from Kroger and such and mixing it in with this.
Right. And the flour is in the plastic. You know, I mean, we had a problem always with, you know, we put out the compostable liners. Yay. Great. That's fine. And we had cardboard we could put in the windrow, but there's also uncompostable materials of all kinds and forks and other kinds of things. And you're always dependent on that new employee in the back of the house at the restaurant who didn't get the training. And so we had to invest in this depackager to get that out of there. And that's made a huge difference in the quality of our compost. 16% of what was going into the windrow and from the food side is now out of that. And so that's all being rejected. We don't have to worry about whether it's got Teflon in the lining of the Chipotle bucket, bowl or whatever. We can just go on with the food itself and compost it. So we're really proud of the process. It's making really good compost, and we're fine tuning it every batch. But we feel good to be a resource for that. And our compost has all disappeared since the start of the pandemic. We're, our sales went up about 80%.
Imagine. And,
Kansas City, I think, is beyond lucky to have a company like Missouri Organic, because that's where all of our food waste ends up. So they have the ability to take, like Stan said, a large volume of compost. And they're dedicated to making a clean product, which I think is equally as or more important. So I really feel like without Missouri Organic, we just wouldn't have the composting systems that we have in place right now.
I think that's great. We've got those solutions. And thank you, Stan, and all of you. I also think we as individuals need to look at how we can reduce the food waste. I mean, you're processing it once it's out there, but ultimately we need to quit producing it. And, you know, what are solutions for that? How do we look at ways? I mean, refed.org is a site I go to, and they're kind of like the drawdown for food waste. They're kind of prioritizing different solutions to reduce food waste. So we don't have to keep it out of the landfill. We just quit making food waste.
Right.
And some of the solutions they seem like very simple things. Eat with smaller plates. So you don't get a big plate full of food, you're hungry, and then you throw it in the trash. So eat on smaller plates and go back for seconds if you need it. I saw one of the recommendations was for restaurants, cafeterias to eliminate the tray. So people would get a couple plates and have to carry them. I mean, logically simple things that they say are going to have a huge impact. Mm-hmm. How do you folks feel about that? Have you had any experience with any of these, David?
One of the things that's becoming mainstream is the ugly fruit. And I think it's Misfits that is doing a really good job of getting all that produce that doesn't look right, but it's perfectly good, and would not end up on the shelves. And people are, I think, becoming better informed about, hey, this is really important to do for the planet. Make sure that food is used and not worry about it being oddly shaped.
Yeah, I hear that referred to as imperfect produce. And I think what happens is the supermarkets, they get the produce in, they just immediately throw away half of it because it doesn't look perfect. And it's perfectly, I mean, there's that word again. It's perfectly edible, nutritious food that's just going directly to the landfill or to a processing system. Stan?
Well, we've been doing a lot of programs on food waste and composting regionally. And EPA has had several really good suggestions. And Food Too Good to Waste is a website we've grabbed onto and built a poster around and an educational program. But there's also an EPA site, Food Too Good to Waste. And they talk about smart use, smart preparation, and smart storage. Smart use means, first of all, make a list, shop to a list. And it says shop in your fridge first, shop in your pantry first. Only get what you don't have. don't double up. Bring it home and prepare it. Wash it, chop it, put it in that little Pyrex bowl with the lid on it so you've got next two meals worth of carrots ready to go. You'll save time and you'll have dealt with it and you'll know where it is. And then label a shelf, eat me first. Put the short-term food on this shelf, right? Roll it up and keep it going. So smart storage, you know, refrigerate the right foods, don't refrigerate, you know, all of that is a very simple but very effective ways to do things. And there's a lot more there. And the EPA's information is on the foodtoogoodtowaste.com.org. We'll get you to the Missouri Organic site that we're building as a hub around that.
David?
Next fall, I'm going to launch a big project for canning, teaching people how to can the extra produce and put it up. And I did that when my kids were little. The best way is with a pressure cooker. And it's like, oh my gosh, Instapot. Yes. People have pressure cookers now. Let's go. Because that in a root cellar. You know, what happened to the root cellars? I mean, we're going back to what made sense. And realizing the scientific urgency of best practices now.
Root cellars and canning. David, you're obviously older than I am.
But you had that in Iowa.
Yeah, there's no question. My grandparents did that. I remember as a little kid playing in the root cellar. So I know what you're talking about. What about restaurants? I mean, are there solutions to help us reduce food waste in restaurants? I've seen some people recommend that rather than buying the big entree, you go in and you buy appetizer plates. You know, you can, and a lot of times those are, you know, happy hour, whatever, on sale. You can pick up two or three appetizer plates for less than you would spend on a normal meal, and you're generating a lot less food waste. Has anybody had any experience with that?
My wife and I split entrees always. A typical entree, I mean, at my advanced age, a typical entree is twice as big as that I need. And, either buy a la carte. You know, you can go off and pull off two or three small items on the side and a house salad and you're set, you know, for half price or less. And that's the way we're handling it greatly, like you suggest.
And so bring your own to-go containers. If you find that your meal is going to be much bigger than you expected, I know, I don't think my husband would ever split an entree with me. So I'm bringing that food home with me. So bring your own to-go containers with you and put it in there. Obviously, we're in a different world right now with COVID. But so if you're ordering extra food, save it. It's going to be good tomorrow, in 2 days, in 3 days. Don't have the restaurant throw it out just because there's extra on your plate.
Absolutely. And bring your own food containers. I mean, a lot of times we're talking styrofoams and plastics if you use the restaurant's carry home. Although I have found in a lot of restaurants, I've seen people ask, would you wrap that up in aluminum foil or something, you know, as an alternative to taking their traditional. So if you don't have something with you, you can always ask them to do something that's, you know, biodegradable. Right. Restaurants, home cooking. What about expiration dates and labeling? I've seen some movements that are, you know, and this is kind of a government-driven thing, where they feel like we could improve the labeling on products. A lot of people are saying that the expiration dates on products are being driven by the marketing groups that want to sell a lot of products. So, you know, the sooner they get you to throw it out, the sooner they can sell you a fresh one. So I've heard about some initiatives that are wanting to get more accurate and standardized, you know, so that we have consistent expiration dates, and then instead of just leaving it up to the packagers to put whatever they want on those. Is anybody familiar with those programs? Stan?
The thing I say to people is that you have a highly sensitive portable chemical detector mounted directly on the front of your face. And, that's your best test. And unless there's if it's infected with a mold or whatever, you'll be able to smell that. And sometimes you can cut the mold off the cheese. You can actually use a lot of the dairy products that aren't taken over by the mold just as well. It's already molded. it's been
cheese is made out of mold. Yeah,
exactly. You know, that we have this paranoia about that, but the date, I don't think I've ever looked at a board on date. Now I can't read them, but the point is it doesn't, just.
Those dates aren't scientific gospel. Those are more marketing. And like you say, use your nose and eyes. And if the food looks good and it smells good and still tastes good, there's really no reason not to go ahead and eat it.
Right.
David, right. You were talking about canning and stuff. It seems like that's a perfect opportunity for this imperfect produce. I mean, if we're going to can, or otherwise preserve it long-term, it doesn't matter what it looks like. Do we have markets, secondary markets in Kansas City now that are specializing in this imperfect produce?
Well, we have After the Harvest, which collects the stuff out of the field. We also have Canby's. Mm-hmm. Maxfield Caniger is doing a terrific job collecting food that's on the way out of the wholesale groceries. This summer, he was having chefs make gourmet meals and giving them away to people that needed them. He's got a whole system and a great warehouse where he's handling this material. So that's another one that, and it's canbesmarket.com, I believe, K-A-N-B-E-S.
Another technique I've heard people talk about in terms of your grocery shopping is to buy loose product instead of the packages. Seems like so much produce is packaged in such large bulks that we're not going to be able to eat it all, and half of it ends up rotting before we can consume it. So if you're going to a market that has the loose produce, you can just pick as much as you think you'll eat and not have to buy those big bags.
Mm-hmm. And I think that as gardeners know, when it's August and the zucchini starts really growing 3 inches a night, that most vegetables come in at a certain time and you have just a lot of them. I mean, it's possible. I know I remember getting fresh sweet corn in Utah from a farm that planted one row every day in the spring. And so they would take that one row, harvest it, and sell it on the side of the road. And they never had any extra. It was just ready. But most places, you've just got so much food coming ready for harvest that it really takes planning to make sure that you don't have food waste in those circumstances.
But then also again,
canning season, the tomatoes used to be $5 a pound. In the middle of peak of the season, they're $1 a pound. That's when you stock up and take them straight to the canner.
So let me see if I can summarize. I mean, we've talked about a lot today. Obviously, we as individuals, and that's kind of our focus here, how can we as individuals make sustainable food choices? And most of us aren't farmers, so we have to take what's at the market. But it seems like, a healthier diet has less meat. It's going to have more of those fruits and veggies you need. So, more nutrition, ideally shopping locally, finding local produce. So eating seasonally, locally, we're not going to be growing the same thing every day, but, if you change your diet with the seasons And, you know, if you do can, or if you know somebody that cans and preserves, you know, that's the way to carry things forward. And then in terms of food waste, there's a lot of techniques there. You know, buying smaller quantities, go to the store more often, buy smaller quantities so that the food doesn't rot. If you're going out to eat, you know, order a la carte, order small plates, appetizers, you know, going into the restaurants, try eating without that tray, you know, just take a couple plates back to your table and then go back. Or exercise going back and forth to the food bar instead of, you know, bringing the whole food bar to your table. So reducing those food waste. And composting, wonderful, because it shows you how much waste you're creating. And that's money out of your pocket. That's nutrition that you need. So, you know, compost or work with a group like, you know, Meredith's company to let them compost for you if you don't want to do that. Home gardening, even better. If you want to take that hobby, if you like to be in the yard, raise flowers, you know, why not raise some of your own fruits and vegetables? It's a great way to turn that compost back into usable product. And I thought Stan's idea was great. You know, if you have children, it's a great way to teach them about that cycle of life. So these have all been great solutions and great ideas that we can all take advantage of. So I want to thank our guests for joining us tonight. You can find a lot of this information on the Climate Council's website. And that's www.climategkc.org. Stan, where can people learn more about Missouri Organic?
MissouriOrganic.com and foodtoogoodtowaste.com.
Great. Meredith, what about Compost Collective KC?
So CompostCollectiveKC.com has all of our information. That's where you're able to sign up. And then also our social media. So we use Instagram and Facebook. And I do want to say on those platforms, we try to share a lot of information on just how to generally buy food smarter and waste less. So that's where we're trying to put out that info.
Thank you. Mark, where can we learn more about Cultivate KC?
CultivateKC.org. And you can also find us on Facebook and Instagram as well.
Great. David, Kansas City Drawdown Society.
Yes, the site is kcdrawdown.org. And there you can get a link to our other site, carbonfootprinteating.org.
Hillary, where can we learn about Mad Hatter Compost Tea?
At madhattercomposttea.com.
So thank you, everyone. And thank you to our listeners. Please join us next month when the Climate Council will look at sustainable mobility, exploring the environmental impacts of how we get there. I'm your host, Bob Grove.